Three, two, one. Patricia Morris Rowe, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you've had a great career as a writer for journalism, writing biographies, memoirs and fiction. What actually made you first become a writer to begin with? What inspired you?
Oh, I was actually a drama major. And really, I love to read, but never thought much about writing. And my college had a junior year program in London for drama and English majors. And I went over there, and there was a teacher, a film teacher. He was also, I believe, one of the art critics or film critics for the Sunday Times of London, John Russell Taylor. And I had written a film review of D.H. Lawrence's A Woman in Love. And I also met my first real boyfriend over there. So I was also a woman in love. And he said, "You are really good. You should be a writer." So I was like on high in London with my boyfriend. And I thought, oh, that's it. I switched from drama and I became a writer, really based on, I always thought I should contact him and say, well, thanks to you, I did become a writer. So that was really the reason. And from then on, I never really looked back.
So did you originally want to do something to do with acting or drama?
And then yes, you just, yes, and I did. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, drama and music.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I sort of realized, oh, I don't think that's going to be a very lucrative career. That's going to be difficult. So then I, for whatever delusional reason, I said, oh, writing, that should be so much more lucrative and easier, which it certainly was not.
Well, when did you end up working for magazines like New York and Vanity Fair? When was that?
Later. I mean, I came to New York after college to go to graduate school at NYU. So I was writing then, but 1981, I started to write for New York Magazine, which was really, as Graydon Carter just wrote in his new memoir, it was definitely the golden age of magazines. So I was very lucky to hit it at that time.
Is that because they were most popular when in that time period?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They had a lot of great writers and you could write at any length. I mean, they were on the newsstands. I mean, it was such a different time. And it was a very exciting, New York Magazine was an exciting place to be in New York in the 80s was really... Everything was going on then. So
how has it changed since then with the invention of social media and computers, etc.?
Well, there are no magazines. So, I mean, I'm writing fiction. So that gives you some idea. No, I mean, there are only a few magazines left and long form journalism, you know, except for some places like The New Yorker. That's pretty much gone, too. So you just don't have that consolidation anymore.
How did then early experiences of working for the magazines help you learn how to tell stories, or was it kind of natural for you?
Well, it obviously must have been somewhat natural because I didn't have a huge amount of experience even when I was hired by New York Magazine. You know, I think sometimes there are certain people who are storytellers, and my Irish grandfather lived with us growing up, so I kind of got a good dose of that. And also, you know, there was, as I said, there were every week there was something really fascinating going on in the city. So whether it was restaurants opening up or new plays, I jumped around a lot. I tended to do their bigger stories for them, but I didn't have a particular beat. You know, I didn't do crime stories or purely cultural, or fashion. I did pretty much everything that was out there.
How much time did you have to do each story? Did it vary, or was it like, you have a day to write this, get it done?
You know, the editor, Ed Kosner, who had come over from Newsweek, was really great. And because I did longer stories, and because when I first got out of college, I worked for a newspaper and realized that I was not a deadline writer at all. So he was very good in terms of letting me take as long as I wanted within reason. For the most part, you did 2 weeks of interviewing, and then for me, it was 2 weeks of writing the story. But the story could be anywhere from 5,000 words to, I think the longest I did was 15,000. So you were doing big stories. 5,000 words was a short story at that point.
And how does that compare to your novels and biographies in terms of preparation and like staying consistent with those kind of things? Because that's obviously much longer projects. So how do you prepare and make sure you consistently finish those projects that have longer deadlines?
Well, it's fear, I think. I mean, for the most part, you have a contract and you need to, and even when I've had contracts, it's taken me a long time. But I like to sit down and write. It's very pleasurable for me. So, and it's just what I've been doing, as my back will attest to. I'm sitting down, you know, writing for many, many years now.
No.
No, I got my husband. He wasn't my husband then, but he was a technology banker. So I was one of the first people that I knew who was working on a K-Pro computer with 64K of memory. And this was it was kind of bulky, but you could carry it around like a suitcase. So that my husband claims that when he went to visit me in my fifth floor walk-up apartment, and there I was sitting there with like whiteout and a ton of manuscript paper balled up in the corner. He said, "Oh God, this is not going to work." So he got me the computer, and I mean, what a change! What a change! You know, no, I mean that was remarkable. It really was. And then, of course, when the internet came and you could do research there, that was the major game changer.
Yeah. Well, you say storytelling is natural. I mean, we are storytelling animals. But do you have a few kind of simple techniques that aspiring writers can use to try and improve their storytelling skills if they're just starting?
I think it depends on what type of thing you are doing. If you're doing a piece of nonfiction, whether it's a book, or it's an article. I think if you can interview as many people as you possibly can, the people tell the story for you. I mean, they really do. And then what you need to do is be true to what they're telling you, but also then you're weaving together their stories. For example, if you're doing a profile of someone, you're going to be spending a lot of time with the profile subject, and then you're going to be interviewing everybody who is connected to the profile subject within reason. I know, and of course, those things would be, those articles are very different dependent on the length. I mean, for New York Magazine, a million years ago, they were, you know, you'd be interviewing 20, maybe 30 people. And the last, one of the last profiles I did was for the New York Times on Annie Leibovitz. And I interviewed a lot of people, except that the piece was also 1,700 words. So you're now trying to cram all of that information into a very, very tiny space, which is far more challenging than doing something at 10,000 words. It's really tough. It's like sculpting.
Yeah. What about for fiction?
You know, I had the first opportunity to do, and I really never had much of a desire to write novels, but a friend of mine who was editor-in-chief then of Amazon's Little A, we were talking, and he said, oh, Beethoven dedicated Moonlight Sonata to some young woman. And that planted the seed. I thought, wow, that's a great idea. So Amazon, I was very lucky. Little A gave me the contract without having to show them anything. And that was, I don't want to say it was easy, but you're really following with Beethoven. There's a beginning, middle, and an end. And you know how that's going to end when you're doing historical fiction, unless you're going to rip up it totally. So, and you're doing a lot of research, which I was used to doing research. So that was, I don't want to say it was easy because it took close to 5 years, but I knew that I had control over that. This one I'm working on, and I think just finished, is a modern story or set in the 80s, which is more modern than the 1800s. Yeah. That was a little more challenging for me.
Yeah. And how are you finding kind of balancing the fiction side of things with the historical accurate side of things? Is like, how is that?
Well, you know, I decided to do, to set this in the 1980s because, number one, that I, of any decade, because I reported on it, I knew it very, very well. And I knew that I wanted it to be somewhat set in the musical world to have some kind of continuity with the Woman in the Moonlight. And there's a character in it who's a Wall Street corporate raider. So that era was important to me. And really, it is historical fiction. I mean, I did have to do some research on that as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you mentioned research quite a lot.
Yes.
You do a lot of research.
Yeah.
How much research do you do? How much time do you spend researching compared to writing? Obviously, it depends on the length of the piece. But for example, Mapplethorpe's biography, how much time did you spend researching versus writing the actual book?
Well, when you say researching, I would say researching plus the interviews. And I did close to 300 interviews on that one. So half and half, maybe. That book was 6 years. So it was... That, yeah, the interviews took up a tremendous amount of time, but had to be done for something like that. And it was my first book, so that was much more challenging, just the learning curve of that.
Yeah, what are some things that you learned from writing that that you were able to apply to other books in the future?
Well, I would never write another biography again. That was the first one. Rule number one, move on. That was, for many reasons, an exceptionally difficult book to do for me. So, or for anyone, I suspect. I think that you have to be... It's interesting, having just reread it, not having looked at it for really 30 years. It, because he was such a controversial figure, you had to interview as many people as you could to get that a real full picture of him. And I saw such through lines this time around that I wasn't necessarily aware of. And a consistency in terms of people's reaction to him that I'd forgotten.
What kind of reaction was it?
Uniformly pretty negative. And that's why the reaction from his friends and actually a lot of critics, I think some felt that I had been unduly harsh on him. And I actually, as a person, one to one, I liked him. But I was surprised at the consistency of the people who really had a lot of negative things to say about him. I mean, across the board, that actually shocked me, because I didn't remember it that way. And it wasn't so, and I had tremendous access to everyone. I mean, I got to everyone I needed to get to.
Is that because he personally chose you? So he kind
of
opened doors.
Yes, he did. I mean, and that was rather random. When I say random, it was for Random House. It was a random thing because I had done a piece for New York Magazine on the fashion designer Perry Ellis, who died of AIDS. They were calling it AIDS at this point because they had not discovered HIV. And it was very, a lot of people read it because Rock Hudson had first come out to say that he had AIDS, but no one else was talking about it. But everyone knew that Perry Ellis was dying of AIDS. And I did write that he was dying of AIDS. And it was just a very, very tragic story. I had written maybe three or four pieces for New York on people with AIDS, you know. And to me, that was the story, although I had written fashion books, fashion stories before. Well, an editor from Random House really then wanted a fashion book from me. And I had been at New York long enough so that I was ready to move on. And I got, and those were the days, I got a contract at Random House and it said unspecified fashion book. I mean, that would never happen today. Unspecified fashion book by Patricia Morrisroe. Well, after working for 4 months, I realized I didn't want to do unspecified fashion book because I could never, I didn't know what I was looking for. I didn't want to do it. I'd also used up some of my advance. So I had to do some quick thinking. And I had interviewed Mapplethorpe in 1983 when he had a show at the ICA in London for the Sunday Times Magazine of London. So I thought, okay, and I knew Mapplethorpe had AIDS. He's having this big show at the Whitney. And I honestly did not know that much about him other than doing this very quick piece. But I thought this is a fascinating trajectory. I could write about the 70s, the 80s art world. And I went back excited to tell Random House about this, the editor and the publisher. And they went, we don't really want this. So no one's going to care who he is. Who knows what he's. So they had to bring in a couple of other editors, and they finally agreed to let me do it. But I had to give back half my advance from unspecified fashion book in order to do Robert Mapplethorpe. So that's how that happened. And then I went to him that summer of 88 and said, can I do your biography? And he kind of said, sure.
So how long did you actually have with him until he died?
I met with him in August of 88, and he died, I believe it was March 89, so not 9 months.
And what was he like with you compared to what people
lovely.
Say about him? Really?
Absolutely lovely. He was always very nice. Always very nice. I would come in. I mean, and it was sad seeing him deteriorate week by week, really. He liked to meet on Sundays because a lot of his friends had country homes and they weren't around. So he wanted the company. So he would have me come rather late, like 4 on a Sunday. And he'd talk. He was not verbal at all, at all. He could not explain his work. It was a challenge. He was always sitting in his Gustav Stickley, very rigid. It almost looked like an electrical chair. And often, you know, dressed very, very nicely. But the interviews with him were extremely tough going. He was not a reader, and I understand that, you know, a lot of visual artists aren't necessarily readers. But no, he wasn't interested in talking about the work, and he really wasn't. If you read a lot of the interviews over the years, he doesn't have a lot to say about his own work.
Doesn't he just kind of talk about that gut reaction or gut instinct, that yes. feeling in my stomach?
A feeling in my stomach. He was a very instinctual type of person. And he just, you know, it was hard for him to put it in context. Not that he did not know the history of photography. He did very well because of his exposure to his former lover and patron, Sam Wagstaff, who was a major collector. So he couldn't discuss it. And it wasn't because he was growing weak or anything. He could not discuss it when I interviewed him in 1983, which he had absolutely no recollection of, because he then said he was totally stoned, which I sort of got the feeling that he was.
Yeah. What, can he talk about other stuff more deeply?
Oh, yes. His favorite subject was sex. That was it. That was it. That's, he would talk about it in great detail, which was all the more poignant because here was a man who was dying. It was more important than the photography. I mean, he would say, my life is more interesting than my art. And I think it was. It was. He had a very, very addictive personality. You know, there was this joke that people would say, who did you see at the mine shaft besides Robert Mapplethorpe? Having gone back to look at the book and reading the people's comments and the studio managers, I mean, it was a three-ring circus, and it involved a tremendous amount of drugs. Tremendous. I mean, he was doing coke every day. I mean, as one studio manager said, he would take a little bit like coffee, and he drank coffee, but it was consistent all day long.
Do you think that was a coping mechanism for something? What do you think was the cause of such an addictive personality?
I think I interviewed his parents, who both, I liked them very much. You know, they had this tiny little house in Floral Park where every house looked exactly alike. His father was a very rigid engineer, and his mother, again, absolutely lovely woman, but she, friends had told me that they thought she was, they called it then manic depressive, but that she was bipolar. So I think there was perhaps a neurological issue there. And I think it had to have been, I mean, not that given what's going on in this country, it's so easy either, but it had to have been so enormously difficult to grow up gay in Floral Park, Catholic, scrawny when you've got an older athletic brother. I just think he felt less than completely. I mean, he knew that he had talent. Interestingly enough, the person who pushed him and he spent a lot of time with was the Catholic priest, who was very interested in his art. And at the time, it was much more Picasso-esque Madonnas. And later, I found out that this priest, he's dead now, but had been accused of being a pedophile. Yeah. So I don't, Robert did say to me, he liked going to the beach with the boys. He belonged to some Christian Catholic boys society, and this priest would always take the boys. And Robert said he really liked looking at the boys. And I didn't pay any attention, that much attention to it at the time. But when I had my book reading, a book reading in East Hampton, a woman came over to me and said, "Don't you know that this priest was abusing the boys?" She didn't say Robert, but all of a sudden, of course, it was too late then, and I wasn't the, this priest only, it was revealed that he was a pedophile much, much later. So do I think something could have happened? Yeah, it's very possible.
Hmm. And from reading a bit of the biography, it seemed that his parents didn't give him a lot of attention that he craved. His mum had quite a lot of children, and his dad was more interested in his older brother. And he just wanted to kind of show people his artwork, but felt like, I don't know, maybe guilty as well about his sexuality and stuff. How?
I think it was a sense of total confusion for him. The mother always claimed he was her favorite. And I'm friendly with his younger brother, Edward. And Edward said that's definitely the case. It was a tiny house. There were six kids. Robert's mother, the grandfather at some point was living with them. I just think his father, Harry, was a very, very rigid engineer who wanted everything perfect. He also took photographs. So I think what fascinated me is that Mapplethorpe then, when he came into the city, even as a young boy, would seek out these, because they had these weird freak shows in Times Square. So this affiliation and fascination with freaks was very, very apparent from an early age.
And I've read parts of it where his father's kind of suspected that he was gay and disapproved of a lot of things he said, calling him worthless. And then also fast forwarding to when his younger brother was his assistant.
Yes.
And Mapplethorpe, Robert, berates him for wanting to leave. And then his younger brother says, I'm not sure, I think it was to you, saying he could see Robert, that his dad in Robert in that moment.
Yes.
And I've read a few different biographies of successful people or outliers or celebrities, and the story of the father seems to be embedded in the son. And I've got a kind of paraphrase quote from Obama saying, "We are often living up to the expectations of our fathers or avoiding their mistakes." And for Obama, it's both. How do you think that? Do you think that was the case for Robert as well?
I don't think he wanted. I mean, his father was successful. He provided for the family. His brother Edward seems to have had a good relationship with him. I think that his father was just very strict. And Robert, by the way, became just as compulsive and as strict as Robert. That was the problem. And I think he was never going to please his father. His father had gone to Pratt, I think, but in engineering. Robert went to Pratt, but then became an artist. His father, I mean, sensibly figured you're not going to make any money doing that. So I think that he wanted really to cut the parents out of his life. He wanted to be, that's why he was always so attracted to these celebrities and these beautiful people. I mean, he was attracted to many different people, but because he did not want to be Bob Mapplethorpe from Floral Park, Queens, which is, you know, a theme for many artists. They want to leave that behind. He was very extreme in terms of cutting them off completely. He couldn't be who he wanted to be if he still had contact with them.
When did he cut them off? At what point of his life did he cut them off?
He pretty much cut them off when he came to New York after Pratt, a couple of years after Pratt. For somebody who was so, well, shockingly brave in his photographs, he was not in his personal life. And when I think he didn't want to let them know that he and Patty were living together, so he told them they were married. So Joan sent Patty a wedding gift and for the longest time did think they were married. Robert's father really, I think, did not at all. So, once he got to the city, they were in the background, far background.
And before he went to the city, didn't he kind of delve into a lot of military kind of things? He got
Yes,
into.
I mean, I think that was typical. I don't think it was just because he liked the uniforms. I think it was that's what you did in those days. You had to go into ROTC, and he became a member of the Pershing Rifles. And for this scrawny would-be artist, he got picked on, although I think there was a lot of fondness that even the people who picked on him, which is sounds like a crazy thing to say, but were also fond of him. But that was just a very bad match for him completely.
He seems to have gone through quite a lot of contradictions. So one time he's trying to like get along with the soldier and become like almost like a soldier or be in the military, and
Yeah.
then he escapes the military by being high on acid and
Yes.
like copping out, and then he becomes this kind of almost complete opposite. But then you see in his photos as well, he's got that kind of macho look with the cigarette in his mouth, and
Yes.
then the complete opposite as well. So was he like that his entire life? Was he quite mercurial? Did he have multiple
Yes,
personalities?
he was, but I think you also have to remember that in that period, it was pretty typical for people, you could be in the military and then you could be a hippie. There was such great and fast social change going on. And I think Robert, in his personal life, told that story very well because, yes, he would go from Pershing Rifles to getting out of that, meeting Patti Smith, everything changing for him, letting his hair grow, wearing sheepskin vests, wearing skull jewelry. It was part of his personal transformation as an artist, but it was also not a tip. His transformation was more extreme than other people, but it was not atypical.
You've mentioned Patti Smith a few times. I've read that your biography got a lot of criticism. You said it yourself. A lot of Mapplethorpe's close friends kind of criticized the biography in a lot of different groups, social groups. How did you handle the criticism from those people?
Well, yeah, I never actually heard from Patti Smith did not like it, and having read the book, I can certainly understand why. I think, first of all, when you do a biography of somebody who is as polarizing a figure as Robert Mapplethorpe, you have to expect that you're going to get a lot of reviews that are all over the place. It also was a time where there were tons of newspapers. So this biography was reviewed everywhere. I mean, the clips that I have are like a box. Whereas now, you're lucky that you get a review on, you're begging people to write something on Amazon. But so it wasn't pleasant. But again, a lot of key art people really loved the book. So it was a balance. Patti Smith was more difficult. I had interviewed her a lot. And I interviewed a lot of people about her. And again, you have to trust the depth and the strength of the reporting. And there were consistent through lines, consistent through lines. I mean, I know that I got that story because she was able to tell her story and then ultimately wrote Just Kids, which I actually didn't read. But there were many, many people. People talked. I was very surprised that everybody was, you know, and at times I would be thinking to myself, do you really want to say this? People just talked. And I think it was because Mapplethorpe's life was so out in the open. Do you know? I mean, he's putting everything out there. So they sort of figured, why not? I should do it as well. And I think with Patty, it became, she disappeared. I mean, completely. I believe 1978, 79, to live with her husband outside of Detroit. And she cut off ties with everyone. I mean, one can speculate what was going on there, but that was a very odd situation there. And because people did not think she was coming back, they were very, very open about her behavior. I mean, she could be very kind, and she could just lash out in a very cruel way. And a lot of people spoke about that.
Hmm. Do you think because Mapplethorpe had died or was dying and Patty seemed to have disappeared, that allowed people to be more confident because they didn't think they were going to get any kind of criticism back from them, because obviously Mapplethorpe would have been gone and Patty Smith seemed to have disappeared?
Yes, I think that's true. I think one of the last things Robert ever said to me was, just don't make me boring. I mean, I don't think he would have minded really any of this, because he told me. I mean, he didn't have to tell me, and he didn't have to guide me to people who he knew were going to probably say very unflattering things about him, or what we now perceive of as unflattering. But, you know, the times have changed so much. I mean, it's fascinating to think about what the reaction to some of those pictures would be now. But yes, people were unbelievably receptive to talking about him. And a lot of them who either worked for him or were close to him were exhausted by him. At the end, they were just exhausted.
Relating to that, in a few biographies I've read, I've noticed that these kind of outlier individuals tend to have kind of a lot of demons. Elon Musk, for example, a lot of people close to him say he goes into this thing called demon mode, where he just, something switches and he just goes really dark. A few minutes later, he's the complete opposite and he's goofing around. And you said if there hadn't been a Patty Smith-like character, I think the book would have been very difficult to write. He really would have appeared to be a total monster. Why was her inclusion of the book so important? And why do you think he would have been seen as a monster without that inclusion of her?
I think she humanized him. And I think that she had a lot of major issues herself. She had to give up a child when, you know, she was very young. Robert told me he thought she was psychotic. She had a lot of episodes where she would hallucinate, fall apart. There seemed to have been, but they found each other and they completed each other in a way. And he was very much in love with her. And I think she with him to a certain extent. And, you know, I didn't find it. I think you always hope that there'll be a story arc and then it comes full circle. And when she comes back into his life, it's very touching. He was very hurt that she disappeared on him. He told me he was very, very hurt, but he would never really say, I mean, he'd complain about her husband, Fred Sonic Smith, who was a guitarist with the MC5. But he really was very careful about what he'd say about Patty and was very happy to see her in the end.
Do you think he had that kind of demon mode where he would switch on people? Because you described him as a monster.
Completely. I mean, and if you're doing the amount of drugs that he did, there was something incredibly manic about going out, picking up men, bringing them back to the apartment. If something didn't work out there, he would run out and bring another man. There was such a extreme sexual appetite that he had that never seemed to be, it was completed in the photographs, I mean, but not for himself, really. And he was, if you take his other relationships, Patty had a lot of her own mental demons. Lisa Lyon, the bodybuilder who he did the book Lady, she had numerous breakdowns, numerous. Milton Moore, who was man in polyester suit, was schizophrenic. He was drawn to those people, you know, playing on the edge, who were completely on the edge.
Is that not opposites attract, similar people attract? Was he like that? And was it also maybe kind of, I remember you saying that Andy Warhol had a similar kind of approach with his Chelsea Girls movie, and maybe did Mapplethorpe potentially kind of emulate that from Warhol and kind of copy that? Or do you think it was just a natural?
I think it was more natural. I do. I just think the attraction to him towards the Catholic Church, he loved the symmetry, he loved the ritual, and he also loved the good and the bad, the contrast. And you see the self-portraits where he definitely, the one with the whip up his ass is looks like the devil. So he liked playing with that imagery. And he could be vicious with people, or he could be charming in his very low-key way. But there was no doubt that both he and then Patty wanted to be success and be successful, and it was success at any cost, really.
When did that belief of wanting to be successful begin for him? Was there a set point or a certain age where he decided, I want to be a famous artist slash photographer?
I think once he came to, he was playing with his jewelry and constructions when he was at Pratt. But I think once he came to New York, they got into the Chelsea Hotel. He knew that Warhol would be often hanging out, although Warhol at that point wasn't so much. The back room at Max's Kansas City, they would try to infiltrate that. Both spurred each other on, you know, to be famous artists. So that was key to them. And how do you go about that? It's finding a patron. And that was very important to Robert. You know, you get a patron and he will pay for you. And he did. Multiple ones.
Yeah. You mentioned Warhol. I know that Robert wanted to befriend him. What was his impression of Warhol once he did end up kind of getting a bit close with him or befriending him?
I think Warhol had really no interest in Mapplethorpe whatsoever. And I think Mapplethorpe did a portrait of Warhol, but I think it was clear Mapplethorpe was never going to be part of that inner circle. So I think it was he was delusional pretty quickly.
Hmm. You did about 300 interviews over 6 years for the Mapplethorpe book. Can you tell us how you gathered all that information and turned it into one story? What was the process like for that?
Besides long, I think you are doing it with a biography. You know it's going to be chronological, so you're putting the interviews together. There's the Floral Park interviews, which was his early life. There's the, you know, the Chelsea interviews. He had very distinct periods. Do you know, not, yeah, you know, not like Picasso's blue period, but it was his childhood. Chelsea, the young artist in New York. You then had the S&M period, which was a definite period. I mean, yes, Robert did his flowers. Robert slowly started to do the portraits, but there was that. And then he switched, and he could turn on a dime. I mean, S&M, that gone with that. And he then realized that he was attracted to Black men, and all other men did not exist for him. So he went through that period. So my interviews would be, and then after that, it was the when he had AIDS, the final period of his life. So I would do the interviews, and then you know, basically at the time, they would be in folders, and then, you know, I knew what I needed. Of course, certain people would crop up throughout all various periods, but that's basically the way I did it.
And we've mentioned there was quite a lot of negative interviews, a lot of negative opinions about Mapplethorpe when you interviewed him. What were some common things said across a lot of the interviews that were negative? Like, what were some specific things people said that seemed to appear?
I think selfish. I mean, one person said to me he elevated selfishness to an art form, and that was it. That he, by the way, people would say, if they weren't necessarily working with him, he could be very sweet, as he was with me. I mean, there was he could be gentle. He could be very polite. There was a kindness there, but I don't know how often it came out. I would say the selfishness but again, so many artists are selfish. So that's, it was trying to get things at all cost and really not caring what happened to the other people.
Was it narcissistic?
Yes, but again, that's probably par for the course. I think that he could use people, and certainly when he went, for me, the most disturbing aspect of the biography then, and certainly now when I read it, is when Mapplethorpe kept on going to this bar where a lot of Black gay men hung out, would offer them drugs, pick them up. And there was a dehumanizing element. I mean, a lot of people think the portraits are beautiful, and they are. But Robert was very liberal about using the N-word and saying things that were, you know, pretty shocking to me. And then also guiding me to interview people who your jaw would drop open just to hear what they would say. I mean, I can't believe they'd be saying this now. Maybe they would. But there was a group of men who would go to this bar, white men, and pick up, for the most part, poor, uneducated Black men, offer them drugs, have sex with them. And, you know, sometimes Robert took their pictures, most famously Milton Moore, who was man in polyester suit, who was broke and schizophrenic. I mean, so Robert loved him. I think he loved his physical appearance primarily, because Milton was so psychotic that at one point he jumped into the Hudson River and he almost set fire to Robert's loft. I mean, there, and then Robert was delusional enough to think that, you know, maybe he should send him back to school. I mean, he was AWOL, I think, AWOL from the Navy. It was a potentially dangerous situation. And Robert just, he then just became a physical creature for him. And Robert really just didn't see him for who he was. And that ended pretty disastrously. But Robert still started to cry when he would mention Milton Moore. I mean, it's something about him touched Robert very, very deeply. But it was really totally crazy relationship.
Do you think that was the most shocking kind of relationship that you got to learn about or there anymore that were even worse than that or as sad as that?
I think obviously the most shocking revelation, because Robert wants, I mean, Robert wanted to be famous. And it, in many ways, it's the story of Faust. I mean, he wanted this fame. And what happens? As he said to me, I just hope I live long enough to see the fame. He knows that he blocks out the idea that he's ill. I mean, he's got swollen lymph nodes. He's clearly contracted AIDS and doesn't want to admit it to himself. So he then, knowing that, even after he's been diagnosed, he's very, very angry. And according to a half a dozen sources, I mean, we don't know. Is he using protection? Maybe. But after he had AIDS, he continued to have sex with these black men, which to me is unconscionable. But he did. So that was perhaps the most shocking and most unappealing is too weak a word, I'm afraid. But yeah.
So did he not even mention that he had AIDS to you when you were interviewing him? Did he completely?
No, I knew that he did. That had come out prior to the Whitney exhibit. Yes.
Yeah. But was he kind of, like you said, was he just completely forgetting he even had it, just acting like?
No, at that point, no. He knew. And you saw, what was sad is that, you know, he recognized it at a certain point because he wasn't able to get out. The sexual contacts were, you know, nil. And, you know, once he lost that sense of sexual desire or the possibility that he was going to find the perfect sexual partner, he still believed that. He started to take photographs of pieces of sculpture. So whereas before he turned men and women into pieces of sculpture, now he was trying to breathe life into pieces of sculpture. And that is, it was very sad. At times he would say to me, you know, I'm dying. So that was difficult. So yes, he did know, but it was almost that fame was such a drug that he thought if he could get a monthly infusion of it, it would be like AZT and he'd be able to stay alive. I mean, that's what kept him going more than anything. The papers, the reviews. He had the show at the Whitney and then did show up, which is amazing. He was very upset when the photographer, Jonathan Becker, from Vanity Fair, took this picture of him showing him looking not his best because Robert, as you know from seeing the portraits, he really wanted to bring out best in people. Well, let's not say best, what he saw as the best. So that was totally devastating for him. He mentioned it to me. He said he made me look like, you know, something out of D.N. Arbus. So, but yes, he did. He was very aware.
Mm. What was it like for yourself through that period of the AIDS epidemic during the 80s? What was it like thinking back at it now?
What was the question, being back in it now, or
what was it like at the time, where, during the AIDS epidemic?
I didn't know in doing the, it was so shocking and so sad. I did not have personal friends who died, but with the pieces I did, there was a person who, there's a circle line that circles New York, and he was a tour guide on the circle line, and I went to the, I did AIDS One Man Story, just focusing on him, and it was incredibly tragic to go and be interviewing him. And he loved these teddy bears, and I gave him one. And the photographer, he's holding all his bears, and the one I gave him is right in the center. So, and then he died pretty soon afterward. You know, I remember interviewing a very young boy who was getting chemo up at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, and you know, I don't know where his family was, probably in the Midwest somewhere, I don't know, and sitting by his bed. And at the time, you had these, the cancer Kaposi sarcoma lesions that look like these bruises. And then, you know, this beautiful young 21-year-old young boy dying. It was incredibly, incredibly sad.
When did you first hear about AIDS? Was it kind of just straight away in the news, like, bang, this is it? Or did it kind of slowly creep up?
I think it was around 1980, 79 or 80. But at that point, it was like a gay man's disease. They did not know you could pick it up as an IV user or something. So, yes. But there wasn't a lot written. I mean, and the band played on Randy Schultz's book out of San Francisco. I think there was coverage in San Francisco, but people did not want to talk about it. I mean, like a Perry Ellis, because it's going to taint their business. So they knew, you knew that people were getting thin, people were not looking good. But I used to live a block from Christopher Street. I wasn't at that point. I was had moved up to the Upper West Side. But if you went down around that area, you saw a lot of young men looking not well.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, really sad. And just listening to what my dad said about it as well, and seeing kind of documentaries on it from when I was younger, it just sounds so scary.
Yeah.
So, so scary. And it's just such a shame that it was known as the gay disease to begin with, because it was just horrible for that group of people.
But, I mean, it was given everything. And you also, I mean, we live in such a different world now. I mean, or we did. And when you look back and realize in the 80s, it was, you know, so hard to announce that you were gay. It was still very, very, people were in the closet. So to have that and then have this disease wipe out so many creative people, choreographers, actors, dancers, everything, that was very tragic.
Hmm. Do you think Mapplethorpe's life serves as a cautionary tale, and what mistakes do you think he made that we could learn to avoid in our lives?
I would say that he would not think he made any mistakes, because he would prefer not to have been dead at 42, and he may not have been if AIDS had come around, although given his extreme drug use. And his mother had emphysema. She was a smoker. The brother died of lung cancer. He ate like nothing. I don't know if he was going to live a very long life anyway. What can you say? Stay close to your family? I mean, that wouldn't have worked for him. I don't know if there are any lessons to be learned because he is a very, very unique character. He is, I mean, there's find a patron, I mean, and then make sure you're nice to them. I mean, don't be selfish. I mean, I think he did what he, don't be a racist might be something that might be good, but he would not have, he was very aware of what was going on. He would not be that person today, or if he was, he would have kept it very much under wraps. But I don't think, and some of the people who he hung out with at, this Keller's bar, I mean, they were prominent in the art world. And I can't believe that they would be going, yeah, we're picking up guys and calling them the N-word at a bar. I mean, that would, they, people would go, what? So I think it was number one, a different time, and that's not to excuse it, although the work itself is powerful. And it's always the question of how do you separate the art from the artist? I do believe the work is very powerful and a lot of it is beautiful. I went to the APAD show at the Armory where all the photographers have their photography galleries have their exhibits, and there was his portrait of the black Ken Moody, the black man who had alopecia, was just there. And it's incredibly striking. It really is. So he did what he needed to do for him, and paid off in terms of his reputation and his place in photography history. Is he as beloved now? I mean, I haven't followed the market that closely in terms of his own, the sales of his photographs. I mean, there are certain key ones that will always, be very important. And he was very careful and very savvy to make sure that he split his. He knew that only a limited number of people were going to put those S&M photographs on the wall. They just weren't. But it gave him the notoriety. People wanted the flowers. I mean, they loved the flowers. He could sell the flowers. They were kind of decorators' flowers. And because he wanted photography to be equal to painting, and even at the time, that time was still kind of secondary art. He kept on doing these unique pieces. He did the platinum prints, he did the platinum on canvas. So he was able to charge a lot more. So he was a very, very savvy marketer. I mean, some of that may have come from Sam Wagstaff, although I think it was kind of intuitive. And then he had the portraits because you need to make money. And then you need to network. So it was a really interesting balance among those three subject matters. It really was. They all balanced each other out.
Yeah, I think having the photographic or artistic kind of talent and work ethic, as well as the marketing skills and the networking skills, is definitely super important. But I think even today, a lot of people that are trying to pursue creative careers don't think about the business or marketing side of things as much as they should do, maybe.
Yes, and he was, first of all, it doesn't hurt when your patron, your lover, the next lover, and then best friend is one of the major photography collectors. Sam Wagstaff had an amazing eye. He had huge connections because he was a curator at the Detroit Institute of Art. So his connections were very deep. He gave Mapplethorpe a exposure to the history of photography that he might not have had otherwise, although before that he had befriended John McKendry, who was a curator at the Met, and McKendry was the one who gave Mapplethorpe his first camera, a Polaroid, and encouraged him to start taking Polaroids. So he knew how to make connections, and connections were a lot easier in those days too. And he knew how to traverse the area from downtown, to bridge the gap between downtown and uptown. He did that quite brilliant.
Yeah, I definitely have noticed a common thread among a lot of biographies is relationships around the world. And I was just wondering how important relationships have been in your career, and if you have any networking tips for people starting out wanting to build those networks.
Gosh, I'm trying to think. Yes and no. I mean, I always thought I wanted to find a mentor, and I'm still looking. But no, I think for me, one thing kind of led to another. But writing is a little different with, I'm just trying to sell one book at a time, not a ton of photographs. So it's a different kind of a career. Obviously, the more people you know, the better in any career. But with photography, it was very important. And Mapplethorpe had something to offer. He had, he could take pictures, but he also was, you know, an exotic person. A socialite from uptown could invite him to a party, and he would be there in his leather jacket and his skull necklaces and rings, and it would be, you know, add sort of a hint of the exotic to any uptown dinner party. So he had that going for him, and then one thing led to another, and one dinner seatmate would introduce him to another person, and you know, that's how he made his connection. But the critical ones for him were John McKendry and Sam Wagstaff.
We've mentioned that you've kind of done a lot of different forms of writing. I was just wondering which kind of form of writing do you enjoy the most out of all of the ones you've done so far in your career?
I like essays, actually. I really enjoy them. It's easier for me to write in first person. I like that. So I would say the essay, and it's short. I would say the essay form really appeals to me. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I've read somewhere quite briefly that you did a book on insomnia. Is that correct? What kind of style of writing was that?
Well, I started writing that because I had insomnia, first of all. And secondly, it was, you know, it's always good to have a hook. And it was around 2006, I think. And there were all of these pieces in the newspaper about Ambien and the dangers of Ambien and Ambien sleepwalkers. And they would, you know, get up in the middle of the night, raid their refrigerator, and then not remember anything. And then the next morning they'd be there and goes, oh, my God, where's the milk and the sirloin steak? So I thought, ah. And then I went and spent a night at a sleep clinic to diagnose, to have, you know, you have electrodes attached to your brain. And that to me was such an absurd experience because I don't sleep well in my own bed. So I'm really, they're going to be testing my sleep in a foreign place with electrodes and some guy looking at me. So I like slept all of an hour. And then they came back, well, you've got, you know, alpha, delta, blah, blah, waves. And
yeah.
So I thought that was so crazy that that became actually the opening of the book proposal. So that was fat. I mean, that was a really fun. It was interesting book. It was an interesting book to do.
So did you mix kind of personal experience with
I did.
research?
I did. And a lot of people just wanted the personal experience, and other people just wanted the how-to book. So I'm not exactly sure that was the best combination. But I couldn't do it any other way, and that was fun for me. It was very interesting because I didn't do well in science in school. So interviewing neurologists and sleep doctors, I came out of that and said, "Oh, I can do this." So.
What are the causes of insomnia? Is there specific causes of it?
I think that there's a genetic component because my mother didn't sleep and my grandfather who lived with us did not sleep either. So there's that. There's also, hyper-aroused brain if you're. So I think there's sleep onset insomnia where people can't fall asleep. Then there's sleep maintenance insomnia where people wake up in the middle of the night. Have a hard time going back to sleep. So there are many causes. Sometimes it's chronic and, one bad night builds on another and another and another. Other times people may be going through a bad divorce and are just very upset and they, for a year don't sleep. Sleep is as individual as the individual, himself or herself. Yeah.
What was it like for you? Did you still have insomnia, or have you kind of got rid of it?
No, I know I'm going to be up for quite a bit, and I make the big mistake of thinking about my work or coming up with ideas, which I did know at a certain point, but it sets off a certain area of your brain and lights it up. I don't know, green or red. So that's a mistake I make. However, there was a wonderful book by a historian, Roger Eckhart. At Day's Close, Nights and Times Past, where he maintains that people have, until the invention of electric light, people had two separate sleeps, first sleep and second sleep. And then with electric light, everything got consolidated. But it was very common for people to go to bed and then get up, like, tend the sheep, do whatever they did, rob cows from a neighbor's farm, and then, go back to sleep. He claims and others claim that's just evolutionary and that's just natural. But we live in a different time where, chances are you do have to get up in the morning. So, yes, but it was so interesting learning about dreaming, and that was fun for me to do.
Are there any techniques to help you fall asleep quicker that you found to be effective?
I meditated for a while, primarily because I wanted to get a good ending for my book, and I just couldn't say sorry, guys. I never slept, and chances are, after you finish your book, you're not going to either. So I did do meditation, and for a while, that was extremely successful. Now, ask me, did I continue with the meditation? No, I did not, which is a big mistake because it can quiet down your brain. But it was like, okay, the book's over, I move on.
Do you have a biphasic sleep pattern then? Do you kind of wake up in the night and then fall back asleep?
Yes, but it will be several hours before I fall back to sleep. But I'm used to that, and I know. And they always say get out of bed, but it's like and read. I mean, get out of bed and read? I don't think so, because you get out of bed and read, and then you're thinking about all the books you should have read or written or didn't write, and yeah. So that doesn't. If you're a writer, the advice of get out of bed and read is not a good one.
What do you do then normally in that
I just
period?
stay in bed, and my latest is I try to think of all the places I've been in the hotels I've stayed in. Somehow that sort of gets me, you know, trying to remember some hotel I stayed in like Morocco in 1971. So I will go that route. I think that's the hotel equivalent of counting sheep.
Yeah. Well, I might try that out if I ever wake up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
You're very good at making complex and specialized subjects simple and understandable for readers. What are some techniques you use to make your writing so simple and clear for people that might have less?
Maybe it's just I'm simple. I don't do it. I mean, that's, I think if you're writing for a general audience, as I always have, that just comes naturally. And I, as I said, I'm not a specialist. So I wasn't an art historian. So, I mean, to some people's dissatisfaction with Mapplethorpe, but I knew that I was telling a human story of what it was like to be an artist during that time period, which was an incredible time period, the 1980s in the art world. So I think it's really just, and with fiction too, although that's totally different. With science, I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I just approached it the way I would want to read it. And I think it's always good to, you know, add some elements of humor to the book. As sad and as interesting as Mapplethorpe was, there were so many scenes that in rereading it sort of made me smile, because it's just, you couldn't believe what was going on. You couldn't believe that this was his world, and you had to see the humor in it. And by the way, he could be funny. He was funny. So I think it's important, if you can, to bring an element of humor into your work.
For your fiction books, do you know the ending, or do you have to figure it out as you write? So do you just start with a beginning, or do you kind of like plan the entire book out before you start writing it? Or is it kind of...
Well, there have only been two. So with Beethoven, someone said to me, Mapplethorpe, Beethoven, you seem very attracted to these very difficult men. With Beethoven, I knew the ending was going to be, he was going to die. I added an epilogue. So that was very different. With the current one I'm working on, no, I just write without an... I wrote this without an outline. I didn't know where I would go from one. I had a vague idea, but not really. I don't know if other people do that. I honestly don't know, but that's how I've approached this one.
Right. So we're getting to the end. I've got a few kind of quick questions to ask you. The first one is, if you have one piece of advice for your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
Be happier. Be happier and appreciate what you've been given then. Yeah, because you're always just moving so quickly from one thing to another. But I think everyone feels this way.
Yeah. Slow down and be grateful for the moment. Yeah, okay. And second one, what books have had the biggest impact on your life, mindset, and success?
Books I've read.
Yeah. What are your favorite books?
The Great Gatsby, for sure. I love Joan Didion's, the essays, the White Album, Slouching to Bethlehem, and probably Edith Wharton's Age of Innocence. I just love those. You know, it's funny because I belong to this book group, and we somebody suggested reading Somerset Maugham novel, which was 800 pages. And these are all really smart writers, and it goes to show what our attention span is now. Everybody just said, I didn't think I could get through it. So, but Great Gatsby is pretty short. So, yes, I love those books.
Yeah, I think reading is the antidote to social media. I think I've heard a quote somewhere saying reading's like forced meditation. I definitely feel now I've started reading more, I'm definitely way more focused and have much longer attention span.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, definitely. I think more people should get off their phones and read a few books.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What drives you to continue your mission now you've achieved quite a lot of success?
What else am I going to do? I mean, this is what I do. I don't know if you ever retire from writing, maybe, you know, but this is the life I've chosen, and I still enjoy it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you still enjoy it as much?
No,
as
I
you
do.
Could? Good.
I do. By the way, the business has changed tremendously. And marketing, it's very, very difficult. It's far more difficult than it ever has been. It just is. I like it.
Yeah, that's good to hear. What is an important truth that most people disagree with you on, if you have any?
I think perhaps I hang around. Most of my friends were pretty like-minded? That's a very good question, but I don't have a good enough answer to it.
That's okay. What are you working on now? You've mentioned it already, but for
I'm working on a novel that's tentatively titled Alto Rhapsody, and it's about a young singer, because my background before acting was music, voice and piano. So it's about a young singer who is going to see Brahms's Alto Rhapsody at Avery Fisher Hall, and someone jumps from one of the balconies, and it just details how that impacts her life, and then she winds up working as a publicist for the same conductor who announces he's going to be putting on Alto Rhapsody again. And Alto Rhapsody, Brahms referred to it as his bridal song because he was in love with Robert and Clara Schumann's daughter. And once he found out she was marrying someone else, he wrote this in a sort of fury of angst and despair. And my heroine is also planning her wedding against the backdrop of having to go through the trauma putting on Alto Rhapsody again. It's funnier than it sounds, actually. Well, I have to sell it. You know, that's the thing with fiction. With nonfiction, you know, unless I was, you know, Dan Brown or something, you pretty much have to. So it's a leap of faith for me. Unlike a little A, where I didn't have to show anything, now I sort of have to get myself ready to get the book out there, which is the most unpleasant part. No, the most unpleasant part is marketing the book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure you'll get it out to enough people.
Thank
enough
you.
People will read it. Patricia Morris wrote, ladies and gentlemen, Patricia, I really appreciate your time. And I've had a great conversation and learned so much. I really enjoyed your biography on Mapplethorpe, and definitely will read more of your books, including that
Thank
one on
you.
Insomnia.
Thanks.
I'll leave the links to all your books in the show notes, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did.